The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various websites. Starting off with using the chair and the cane at the same time. To continue our article from the NFB in their monthly newsletter, how to use a cane as a wheelchair user. And now we move on to the real meat of the question. How do you use a white cane and a wheelchair at the same time? The first thing I will say is that there is not one single answer to this question. There are many types of wheelchairs and power attachments, and many different individual needs. However, I will try to cover the main options available to you, and we will talk separately about power chairs and manual chairs. Power chairs. If you use a power chair, I have good news because your answer to this issue is much simpler than manual chair options for most. The majority of power chairs that I know of are operated fully one-handed, leaving the other hand free to use your cane as usual. This certainly gives many power chair users an advantage in learning to use their canes from their wheelchairs. So long as you have enough hand function in at least one hand to use a white cane and enough hand function in the other to operate your chair, you shouldn't have too many other factors to worry about. The primary consideration will likely be in which hand to use the cane and which to use the chair control, particularly if you do have issues with hand function. And you may want to try a wide variety of joysticks and control methods for your chair to find what works best for your needs. If hand function or coordination is an issue such that using a cane in one hand and chair controls in the other is not possible, but one hand can still use the cane, you may want to look into alternative control methods for your chair that do not require the hand. I will admit to knowing extremely little about these alternatives other than that some do exist. However, so this will be something you will want to research heavily on your own time to determine if they would work for you or not. There are certainly some who will simply not be able to use a cane and operate their chairs independently at the same time, due to the nature of their disabilities and hand function in particular. But it may still be worth researching as many options for chair controls as possible if you have the ability to use a white cane. Note, if you use a power chair which allows you to adjust the height of your seat for easier access to tables or conversations, you may want to pick a consistent seat height at which you keep your chair when traveling, at least while you are still learning, and find an accessible way to return your seat to that same height. Inconsistent seat heights when using your cane could produce varying reaction time with your cane due to changing the angle at which your cane extends forward and thereby altering exactly how far ahead your cane tip is from one outing to another. Manual chairs. We manual wheelchair users often have to get a little more creative about how we operate our chairs and canes at the same time. The typical manual wheelchair requires the use of both hands on the push rims, which does not leave a free hand for the white cane. There are several options to try out, however, so the answer need not necessarily be to just use a power chair instead. The first option, requiring the least specific chair design and augmentation choices, is to hold both the cane handle and one push rim at the same hand, sweeping the cane between each push as you move. I confess that I have had significant trouble learning how to perform this technique. However, I have met several manual wheelchair users who do, one of whom was our very own late Triva Olivero, as she described in an article she wrote for the Future Reflections magazine entitled, From Troubles to Triumphs, Using a Cane from a Wheelchair. You may need to experiment quite extensively with this technique to determine if it will work for you. Trying different grip positions, arc movements, and potentially different push rims, shapes, and textures. Some may need to wrap the whole hand around both the cane handle and push rim. Some may split their fingers between cane and push rim like some crutch users do when carrying other objects. And some may only use the palm or heel of the hand to push the wheel and so have the cane wrapped with all of the fingers. Making this technique work can be very individualized and require plenty of trial and error. However, if you can achieve it, it will often allow you to have the greatest choice and flexibility in your chair features, since it does not require any special customizations to make it work. When using this technique, however, you may want to pay special attention to your cane arc to ensure that it is even, because this technique means that your arc will begin with the handle held off to the side instead of the center of your body. It can require more practice to ensure your arc does not fall too short on one side or the other. I have personally found myself prone to not sweeping far enough out on my right side when experimenting with this technique, leading to swiping my right push rim on things too frequently as I pass. If you find this technique effective for you, be sure to pay close attention to your cane arc as you practice it in order to build good habits. A second option is a one-arm drive system on your manual chair so that both wheels can be pushed with only one hand. These systems place both push rims on one side, the standard push rim that controls the wheel on that side, and a second smaller push rim that controls the opposite wheel via a removable axle. To move forward or backward, the user grips both push rims at once, and to turn, you only operate one push rim. One-arm drive systems are used most often for those with one-sided upper limb differences or significantly reduced hand and arm function on one side, but they can be repurposed for those of us who need a hand free for our second mobility aid. The largest potential downside to this feature is that it can be more challenging to push yourself long distances or up hills with only the power of one arm. It can also make the chair slightly heavier overall and require some dexterity, so it may be best for those with reasonably good hand function and upper body strength, or may need to be augmented with a power assist attachment. It can also lead to your chair arm building up a bit more strength from pushing compared to your cane hand, but so long as you do not mind some slight asymmetry of your arms to those who look closely enough, a one-arm drive system can offer great freedom to use your cane normally in the other. It also leaves your cane hand free to hold the cane in the center of your body if you are able, rather than off to the side, avoiding the more complex cane arc work involved in the first option we discussed. This customization can be quite pricey, however, and so you will want to ensure that you have a wheelchair occupational therapist, OT, who is very good at writing medical justifications for your desired features. A third option, assuming you have leg function, is foot propelling. This is how I have personally chosen to use my manual wheelchair most of the time, because my disability allows me to do so. This option will certainly not be possible for many whose disabilities prevent it, but if you are physically able, foot propelling can be a great option that leaves both of your hands free, allowing even more flexibility than most power chair users. I am often seen on my college campus rolling along with my cane moving in one hand and a Starbucks cup in the other. It also allows me to keep my cane centered in front of my body, avoiding the more complex cane arc practice required of the first technique, and having my feet on the ground allows me to get a little extra feedback about the surface as I would when walking. Having my non-cane hand free also means that I can use that hand for extra leverage on small slopes or when turning, or even just for a little extra momentum on occasion. However, for larger slopes, foot propelling can be quite difficult on its own, and so you may find yourself needing to use both hands for a push or two with a sweep of the cane in between, or opting for a power assist attachment, as I have. The major downside to foot propelling, however, is limiting your options for rigid frame wheelchairs, as the fixed foot plate will inevitably get in your way. However, some manufacturers, such as Tylite and Sunrise Medical, offer rigid chair models and customizations that include split flip-up or fully removable footrests, so it can still be possible to have both if you can get insurance to pay the extra price for it. I plan on going for this in my next chair. Do also note that if you plan to use foot propelling as a primary technique, your seat height will need to be much lower to ensure you have good traction. You may also be able to make use of some combination of both foot propelling and pushing with one hand if you are able to do so, but neither one is good enough on its own. Having the strength of both feet and one arm may be a great combination for some people, depending on your disability. Or even one arm and one leg if one of your legs is capable of foot propelling but the other is not. You may even be able to combine foot propelling with a one-arm drive system to make this method more effective. I do not have a one-arm drive system on my current chair, but just having one hand on my left wheel can give me a little extra speed or power from time to time. If you do this without a one-arm drive system, however, be aware that putting only one hand on one wheel like this may sometimes cause you to turn or veer slightly in the opposite direction. I have found that my feet doing most of the directing largely sidesteps this issue, but be sure to pay attention to your trajectory when doing this to stay on track. Power assists. If manual propulsion on its own will not meet your needs well enough, you may also consider a power assist attachment. This is a motorized device that attaches to a manual wheelchair in different ways to enable the user to have some power at their disposal while not losing the overall lightness and maneuverability of a manual wheelchair. Power assists come in three primary configurations. The first category includes options such as the Smart Drive, SMOOV, S-M-O-O-V, Impulse R90, E-M-P-U-L-S-E, R90, Klaxon Twist, that's K-L-A-X-O-N, and Light Drive, which come in the form of an extra motorized wheel attached to the back of the chair between the large rear wheels, which is operated by a one-handed control unit that consists of either buttons or dials. Rear-mounted power assists usually cannot steer for you. However, they may be best for blind users who are able to steer either by foot propelling as I do, or by moving their hands between the cane plus control unit and the wheels. The second category are rear wheel replacements that have power built in and are activated either by pushing them manually or operating a control device like a joystick. With manually pushed powered wheels, they are steered the same way as regular rear wheels by using your hands on the push rims. With joystick powered wheels, the joystick allows you full directional control with one hand, essentially turning your manual chair into a power chair. Some available manually operated power wheels include the E-Motion and the Navi 1 wheels, N-A-V-I, capital O, capital N, capital E. And these may be well suited to those who are able to hold the cane and push rim in one hand, as they cannot be operated one-handed. Some joystick-controlled options include the E-Fix and Navigo wheels, which can be great for those who need one-handed control, and some powered wheels like the Impulse M90 can do both joystick and manual push power. These options are great for blind users who want their power assist to be able to handle the steering. The final category includes choices like the Firefly, Batek, Klaxon Click, that's spelled K-L-I-C-K, Tri-Ride, and Impulse F35, which consist of an extra motorized wheel mounted to the front of a wheelchair. Front-mounted power assists lift the front caster wheels off the ground, effectively turning your wheelchair into a tricycle. They typically have handlebars on top, which the user must use to steer. I will personally admit that I have largely excluded front-mounted power assists from my own pool of options because they obstruct the use of a white cane. Based on my experience trying them, they can also be somewhat difficult to control with only one hand on the handlebars if the other is using a cane, though readers may want to do their own research. These are all of the options that I have thus far discovered for manual wheelchair users. For some, however, none of these options will be suitable, even if they would be able to push a manual chair in the traditional way, if they did not need to use a white cane. And in these cases, it may indeed be necessary to move to a power chair. I have found that I and other blind wheelchair users have been pushed unnecessarily toward a power chair simply on the basis of white cane use, without being given the choice to explore options that may work perfectly well for us. But as I have hopefully driven home already in this guide, there will always be exceptions and edge cases for whom none of the other suggestions here will work. I believe in making sure your wheelchair meets your physical mobility needs before making changes based solely on the use of the white cane, because as we wheelchair users know, an ill-suited wheelchair can do more long-term damage to our bodies and our health. But there may be situations in which the second best option is preferable if the drawbacks are minor enough to make the ability to use the cane significantly more possible, which can sometimes mean using a power chair instead of a manual. Because every case can be so radically different from the next, however, I highly recommend requesting from your wheelchair OT to be able to physically test out various options with your white cane before making a final decision. Some wheelchair seating clinics can offer temporary loaner chairs that share some of the features of the chair you are considering. And if not, you may want to consider visiting the nearest to you mobility aid showroom and spending several hours trying out options firsthand. I guess I'm going to have to make it part three for this. Also from the NFB June newsletter, part two of the Super Braillers and the play drama. In between rehearsals, I tried to practice, but our play was about Louis Braille, so some of the words and names were French. I could barely read English words, let alone French ones. At the next rehearsal, again, the Super Braillers took off. I tried to follow along, but after several page turns of the play, I lost my place. When it was my turn to read again, I was lost and asked the cast to skip me. It was looking bad. I wanted to be a part of the cast, but felt that if experience truly did not matter, some kind of a consideration should have been taken for a novice, like I was at the time. The other cast members were laughing and bantering with one another, and I felt alone. The director, Debbie Brown, and another cast member, Sharon Manecki, called me individually to offer me help, but I was in my feelings by then and too proud to ask for assistance. With only two rehearsals left, I realized I had to go to Plan B. I stopped trying to practice the whole play and just focused on my lines. I only had two. Therefore, I memorized my lines and the lines immediately before them as a cue. At the third rehearsal, I was able to perform with the cast. By the fourth rehearsal, my solution had worked, and I had no problems performing. On the evening of the performance, when the cast sat together for the first time, I was hoping to get to know someone. Maybe that would have happened if I had chosen to have dinner with the cast, but I did not have a room at the hotel. I commuted from home to save my money. When I arrived for the play, most everyone had a seat already and was familiar with the person they were sitting next to. The person I sat next to when I performed did not say one word to me at the play. This was clearly not an intentional snub, but as I said, I was hoping to get to know someone, and I thought more people would appreciate the courage it took for me to get on the microphone and perform with more experienced Braille readers. I did not feel the love. As the saying goes, perception is reality. I think most of this was in my head, and I was just in my feelings because I was embarrassed. I am now proud to call the person I sat next to at the play 5 years ago one of my closest friends. Her name is Melissa Riccobono, and she is, among other things, the co-host of the Nation's Blind podcast. From journals.sagepub.com. Chronic pain in individuals who have visual impairments, a systematic review, by Carlos Mora, M-O-R-A, Mark P. Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N, Jordi Miró, M-I-R-O-Q, 2026. This is an abstract. Introduction. The purpose of the systematic review was to summarize the state of knowledge regarding chronic pain in individuals who have visual impairments, for instance, those who are blind or have low vision, with respect to, number one, the prevalence, impact, and predictors of chronic pain, number two, the assessment instruments that have been developed for assessing pain in individuals with visual impairments, and number three, the efficacy of the psychological and exercise-based treatments for the management of chronic pain in this population. Methods. A bibliographic search was carried out using three databases: Science Direct, PubMed, and the National Center for Biotechnology Information. From their inception to July 2024, results, a total of 437 articles were retrieved, 73 were selected for evaluation, and 8 were included in the review. Discussion. The findings from the reviewed studies show that chronic pain, chronic neck and upper back pain in particular, are common in individuals with visual impairments. Very few studies were identified that developed or examined the psychometric properties of pain measures, or that examine the efficacy of psychological or exercise-based treatments for individuals with vision impairments. Additional research is needed to understand the nature, impact, predictors, assessment, and treatment of chronic pain in individuals with vision impairments. Implications for practitioners. Research is needed to develop assessment measures that are sensitive to the needs and characteristics of this population. There is very little data on the efficacy of psychological and exercise-based treatments for this population. It is of particular importance for rehabilitation professionals to understand that the undertreatment of pain may prolong ocular morbidity in this group of individuals, and that high levels of acute eye pain intensity might be responsible for a poor response to treatment. From Perkins.org, the CVI assessment, introduction to the direct assessment. Part of the Perkins CVI protocol, the direct assessment is a customized in-person evaluation that shows the impact of CVI and tests supports. Written by Rachel Bennett. When it comes to understanding cerebral cortical visual impairment, CVI, the most important data doesn't always live in a medical file or with scores and numbers. It lives in the way an individual engages with their world, how they might tilt their head, find a favorite item, navigate a busy place, or interact with others. After the files are read, the families and team members interviewed and the observations logged, we arrive at the final and perhaps the most dynamic stage of the Perkins CVI protocol, the direct assessment. There's a hot link for that. This isn't a simple surface-level stock battery of tests. It is intentional detective work, a key part of fully understanding CVI's impact and how the student uses all of their skills for access is to always wonder. Full access and support comes from a team and evaluation process that continuously wonders, asks questions, and takes the student's lead. By adopting an investigative mindset, practitioners move beyond standard checklists to uncover the specific conditions and compensatory strategies that unlock a student's world. As the final step before report writing, the direct assessment is where the data meets the individual. It requires a shift in perspective, from passive observer to active investigator. In this article, we explore what happens in the direct assessment. This person-centered approach uses specialized detective skills to identify the exact supports and conditions a student needs to find success. What is a direct assessment? The direct assessment is the intentional face-to-face interaction between the evaluator and the student. While the observation phase is about watching the student navigate their typical day and routines, the direct assessment is about active engagement. Here, the evaluator intentionally presents activities and materials to clearly understand how the student is impacted by CVI, including any lingering questions, concerns, and uncertainties that come from interviews and observation. Learn the various compensatory skills the student uses. Try out different strategies in real time to see which ones provide the best support. Determine which accommodations are the most effective for the student. Key principles of the CVI protocol's direct assessment. What sets the Perkins CVI protocol apart is a departure from surface-level testing in favor of two guiding pillars. The investigative mindset. Think of the evaluator as a detective. You aren't just checking boxes. You are uncovering the why behind a student's CVI visual and behaviors and identifying the compensatory strategies they use. You are focused on all the information you can gather through active engagement and observation and then on finding strategies that work. Person-centered design. Activities and materials are customized to the student's interests, abilities, and needs. This ensures the session feels like play with purpose rather than a cookie-cutter evaluation. You can learn more. What makes a comprehensive CVI assessment and why does it matter? At the hot link. From data collection to action. A direct assessment should never be conducted cold. It is fueled by the data gathered during the parent and team interviews and observation. An example of an inquiry loop. The data, a parent notes, he loves his blue truck. The investigative question, does he recognize the truck because of its color, its shape, or the routine of playtime? Can he generalize the recognition to other forms of trucks? The direct action. test these variables using direct assessment activities. Present several blue items, including the familiar truck. Does the student find his truck? Does he need prompting? How does the student engage with these items? For example, touch, sorting, picking up each and bringing it close to his eyes, or asking questions. Does the student miss items on a certain side? Place the blue truck in the room and observe if the student notices it's there and from how far away he noticed it. Present different colored trucks or present a different colored truck with another item. Ask them to find the truck. Place their favorite blue truck with another non-identical items. Do they find it? Present photos of their favorite blue truck. Do they recognize it in two-dimensional form? Present a cartoon photo of a truck and a black and white photo of a truck. Does the student recognize these as trucks? From this inquiry and many others throughout the direct assessment, the evaluator is able to gather quality information about CVI's impact. The direct assessment will reveal visual recognition skills and compensatory strategies. These will be captured in the final report and help support accessible instruction and learning materials. How do evaluators plan for a direct assessment session? A productive assessment requires a robust game plan to ensure the evaluator captures the full picture of a student's access. Learn about the student's interests and what will keep them engaged from file review, observation, and the parent-caregiver interview. No two assessments look exactly the same. Whether Peppa Pig, Transformers, or World War II history motivates a student, weave those interests into 2D materials, 3D objects, and videos. Know the student's reliable responses. How do they show they are visually aware or recognize an item or person? Some can speak their answer. Others show this in various ways, such as body language, vocalizations, gestures, and touch. Complete a direct assessment plan found in the Perkins CVI Protocol Workbook. Hot link. It outlines activities, materials, and any needed items from the family, for instance, favorite toys, videos, photos of family members. Set up the assessment space ahead of time. Minimize distractions, lay out items, and curate specific lighting and positioning conditions. What are evaluators looking for? During the direct assessment session, evaluators are investigating how the 16 CVI visual behaviors uniquely manifest in the student, how they use compensatory strategies, and what accommodations and supports match the student's needs for access. Evaluators simultaneously draw in information from file review to ensure the environment and assessment activities are motorically, that's even a word, developmentally and cognitively appropriate. By ensuring the task matches the student's physical and cognitive strengths, the evaluators are then able to observe a true reflection of their visual processing and compensatory skills. Broadly, the evaluators assess looking, visual regard, the student's ability to look directly at elements of the visual world around them. This includes examining peripheral visual awareness, direct visual attention with eye-to-object contact, as well as their ability to sustain their gaze on materials and people, and the associated wait time required for each of these skills. Understanding and recognition. The student's ability to visually recognize the materials, environment, and people they encounter, and the factors that either support or detract from their success. Evaluators also investigate a student's ability to recognize and understand using compensatory strategies. Interacting, the student's ability to physically interact with the materials they are visually presented with, including the visual motor skills associated with both their upper and lower limbs. Compensatory skills and strategies needed for understanding. These may include using and relying on alternate senses to gain information, such as touch, sound, and smell, and using compensatory strategies such as color coding, context, memory, and prediction to support understanding. I'm going to have to make this a to be continued also. I've run out of time for this week's episode of Vision News. I hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next week on Doorside Reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.